Part 3. Abaddon. And they had tails like unto scorpions, and there were stings in their tails, and their power was to hurt men 5 months. And they had a king over them, which is the angel of the bottomless pit, whose name in the Hebrew tongue is Abaddon, but in the Greek tongue hath his name Apollyon. One woe is past, and behold, there come 2 woes more hereafter. Revelation 9:10-12. With an host of furious fancies, whereof I am commander, with a burning spear and a horse of air, to the wilderness I wander. By a night of ghosts and shadows, I summoned am to tourney, 10 leagues beyond the wide world's end. Methinks it is no journey. Anonymous. Tom O'Bedlam's Song. Chapter 17. December 20th. Terror. General Sampson had gotten the summons back in the daily packet from Abaddon. As usual, it had been choked with demands and threats, but this time, on top of the bundle that had been thrown through the small, highly stable gateway that was here beneath the geographic center of the Northern Hemisphere on all 3 worlds, was a sheet of thick yellow paper. He had known instantly what it was, a summons from Echidna. He now sat miserably on a packed bus, on his way to the sort of meeting from which one should not expect to return. He had come back not only to his own beloved form, the marvelous darkness of his scales, the proud flash of his bright red eyes, but also to a world where he did not need to dose himself with anti-allergen, then remain rigidly shifted for hours, all the while itching like mad in every stifled scale on his body. He didn't want to die, but more, he was afraid of torture, and they would torture him, of course, as a lesson and warning to others. It would happen in some auditorium, full of laughing, cheering underclass, delighted to witness the abnegation of an overlord. They would rip off his still-living skin and make him dance in the cold, and kids would come up and rub salt into his white, exposed musculature. They would roast his haunches and force him to attend the banquet, dressed, no doubt, as a clown. It was she, that damned high-born Captain Maisel, she and her accursed father, who had engineered this. He had hoped that a victory over the humans would bring him real wealth at last, and the power that went with it. Instead, the starving billions who were marked to go swarming through the 14 huge gateways when they opened tomorrow would instead have to be kept here, and their rage and their rebellion would only become worse. And he, of course, would have no souls to sell. But he wasn't defeated, not just yet. He might be able to talk his way back to Earth, because even if he couldn't open the gateways to the people of Abaddon, he could bring back all those millions of souls, full of memories of love and joy, treasures that were not available to anybody here. But not right now. Right now, he was just another miserable, frightened man riding a rickety bus down the Avenue of the Marches to Government House, one among 50 in the old vehicle. He listened to the gas hissing uneasily out of the tank on the roof, coal gas, supposedly less polluting than the powerful fuels available to the elite. Actually, nobody cared about the brown sky. What they cared about was the fact that coal gas was cheap, and, like sails at sea, therefore the best way to transport underworlders. On both sides of the broad street stood government buildings, and ahead, the grandest of them all, where he was supposedly to receive new orders. There was a lot of traffic in the jammed bus lanes. Occasionally, also, an authority vehicle raced past in the restricted lanes. From time to time, an air car whistled past overhead. He didn't even look up. He deserved that life. He deserved a place among the elite, even on the board of directors itself. They finally came to the Street of Joy, marking the center of the long government esplanade. The wailing cry of a siren caused the bus to stop with a jerk. Children in white-suited rows sang an anthem praising the achievements of some committee or other. The tune was always the same, but the committees changed with the political climate. The standing space was crammed with as many as 5,000 naked underworlders, all bound, some screaming their innocence, others in tears, others stoic. Lawyers in the blood-red hoods that signified their profession moved about among the committeemen and their friends, trying to get various orders signed, buying and selling the condemned. Every so often, one of them sent a runner into the rows of prisoners, generally coming back with a young woman to be raped to death at a party later. The stench of prisoners' vomit was sour on the air. A platoon of young leaders in their sky-brown uniforms and black caps marched up to the first row, swinging their arms and singing with the choir, then began slitting throats, causing one and then the next prisoner to spray blood and writhe, then slump. The boys were getting kill badges. There'd been a battle with the Unionists last night, a ferocious encounter at the wall, which we appeared to have won. Of course, it was always impossible to be certain, but such a cheerful execution morning did suggest that the news was true. The Union was nearly finished, reduced to a few hills, nothing more than a park, really. It was surrounded by the vast planetary city that was the corporation in all its might, its wealth beyond imagination, its poverty beyond belief. That was why they had to expand into Two Moon Earth. That population pressure had to be relieved, or there was going to be an explosion here, and Echidna and her class were going to have their own throats slit. Having each done 10 or 15 victims before their parents' cameras, the boys withdrew. One, who had been urinated on, remained kicking his victim to death. After he went strutting back to the grandstand, a soldier like Samson himself, also a general, squeezed the bulb that activated a multi-projectile delivery system that stood on a rickety army wagon. Instantly and without a sound, the 5,000 condemned were turned to meat. Then he snapped his whip, and his great orange syrinx warbled and hooted angrily, but trundled off happily enough when it realized they were headed back to the central vehicle pool. In the bus, total silence. These were all Blue Pass people, all from the underworld neighborhoods, just like the people who were now being harvested by the bone spiders that had come lumbering up out of their warrens at the first scent of blood. The animals would strip off the meat and leave it behind, and carry the bones into their lairs. Every underworlder alive was afraid he would end up in the next collection. After all, the executed had been tortured, most of them by having capsicum injected under their skin and into their anuses, or pellets of plutonium pressed into their eyeballs. He'd seen the globular orange messes that had replaced many of their eyes, had watched the steam curling up from their bobbing heads. You'd say anything, given that kind of pain. And anything would invariably include implicating anybody you were asked to implicate in whatever plot might be imagined. He might have been implicated. Maybe it wasn't political at all. Maybe that was why he was here. The bus started with a jerk and a loud mechanical whine. The roadside was littered with the remains of exploded buses, inside some of which could be seen the pale green bones of the dead. Behind them, shrill screaming began. The elite, had flitted away in their air cars, and now people rushed out of side streets, their scavenging permits flapping on their backs, meat bags in their arms. There would be soup tonight. The bus shuddered and popped. Would it explode? He found himself wondering what he wanted more, an end to this misery of a life, or a chance to talk his way out of whatever trouble he was in. Now came the four tones that preceded morale service announcements. Sick though everybody was of morale service and its lies, they all clapped and cheered. The bus's speakers crackled. There was a brief hiss, then a moment of ear-splitting feedback.
"Are you on your way to your designated Earth station?"
A woman's recorded voice shrieked, crazed with delight.
"Attention, please! Earth stations are now receiving colonists. You must be at your Earth station by midnight tonight."
All the screens on the bus came to life with children singing and dancing in some green fantasy of a world.
"Yes, more and more people every day are buying their tickets. Earth is huge and it's rich, and there's room for all in the new lands, room to dream."
Samson knew the reality, of course. Much of the existing land mass was being sunk into the sea, exposing vast ocean flats that would be where these poor fools would have to build. The reason was simple. The seafloor was full of methane and sulfur hydrates, which would melt in the air and change the atmosphere to the same richly sulfurous mix enjoyed here on Abaddon. Cheap terraforming, in other words. Each family that went would receive a gaggle of human slaves, which would die in a few weeks or months. At least human meat was edible, if you could manage to get used to that creamy texture.
"Building one."
Samson got to his feet, then stepped out. He hurried across the wide, black tarmac. Somewhere in the depths of the city, there was the roar of an explosion, followed by wailing sirens and the appearance of hundreds of bright red police air cars hovering like great wasps, their grapples dangling ominously. Do anything that appeared menacing, and they were liable to snatch you up and drop you 100 leagues out at sea. They'd go in low so that you'd drown instead of die of impact, and the press would show up to tape the spectacle. Or they'd drop you amid pleasure craft, and people would use you for target practice. The reason for all the brutality was simple. Fear works. 10,000 years ago, the corporation had been a loose confederation of free companies, even some tribes, and even more ancient political units. But with growth had come mergers, and then the disastrous battle over the two human Earths that had been lost in the end by all the combatants. This had been followed by long years of population growth, coupled with a gradual consolidation of power, until now, when an elite million ruled a land jammed with 3 billion underclass. Attempting to seem confident, he strode up the steps, brushing at his uniform, trying to remind himself that it meant something in a government context. Here, a general's service stripes were important. After all, they'd put him in charge of what was arguably the most important project in corporate history. So why was his craw filling with vomit?
"Samson, General," he managed to mutter when he reached the desk.
He handed over his orders, his passport, his clearances. The young clerk was a pureblood, dressed in the blue silk uniform of the intelligence service. He had fine white scales and eyes that had been surgically altered from piercing gold to a much more genteel eggshell blue. He read the documents, then pressed a button on his desk. 2 guards appeared, one an underworlder like him in a black uniform, the other upper class, and dressed in the lovely green that the fashionistas called memory of the sky. In a military uniform, it indicated serious power. The only place you could still see a green sky on Abaddon was in the very heart of the Union, amid the fields and the streams. The clerk handed them Samson's papers. He followed them back through the lift area to a private elevator that had an ominous, even legendary, reputation. Many a soldier had ascended to these highest floors and never returned. As he stepped into the pink marble interior, he entered another world, where every detail was sumptuous and perfect. The lift had no controls. It was controlled from elsewhere, and he stood to attention as it rose. He thought to review his life, but could not stop his mind from imagining torture and how he would fail in its rigors, and they would all see and know the cowardice that, in his most secret being, he felt defined him. He thought about death constantly, wondered at what it would mean no longer to be, and feared above all things the destruction of his soul. This was why he had risen so extraordinarily high. It was his willingness, which he detested in himself, to do anything he needed to do to prove his loyalty to his betters, even if it involved lies, cruelty, and pointless killing. His journey upward was a desperate flight to safety. The doors opened, and bright light glared into his face. He tried to control his hearts, but could not. The rhythms synchronized into panic mode, and he knew that his state of fear would be flaring alarms in some nearby monitoring center. What he thought might be a board member came and stood before the light so that he was a black shadow to Samson, his face unrecognizable.
"You have 20 hours before the gateways open. You're not even close to being ready."
Samson took a breath. He thought he knew that voice. He thought it was Beleth himself, the master of all the males, Echidna's husband, in effect, the king of the world.
"We're right on schedule, sir."
"You're a liar, of course."
He thought as quickly and carefully as he could, considering that his mind was racing with fear.
"They can't defeat us. They're only human."
"That's your mistake, and I'm surprised at you. We knew you were arrogant and venial, but who isn't? I had not taken you to be stupid."
"No, sir."
"And neither are the Earth people. The full-blooded Earth human is smarter than we are, as you know. They lack only experience, this new species, to make themselves masters of the three worlds. Remember that they already have two, which we do not."
He seemed to want to engage in conversation. Samson was compelled to respond. He cast around for something positive to say.
"They are a more advanced form than us, it's true, sir, but they have no idea how easy it is for them to pass through gateways. They're ignorant."
"Thanks to the work of our forebears. Can you imagine what a human army would do here? Bringing hope, happiness even, to people who cannot be controlled except by fear?"
"That would be an extraordinary misfortune, but I don't think it's one we need to worry about. They are far from realizing that they can use gateways at will, at any time."
"How about the Union intelligence agent in the one-man universe?"
"That's going well, sir."
"In what sense, General? Have you killed him?"
"I expect that to be confirmed on my return," Samson replied.
"But it's not confirmed now."
"No, it's confirmed, in the sense that we got an assassin through, so yes, I can confirm that."
"How did you get an assassin into a place that we can't penetrate, General?"
"Well, we are able to, in a limited way. And remember, the closer to the moment of passage we come, the easier it is."
"So, the agent is definitely no longer a problem? You can guarantee this?"
Samson forced acid back out of his craw and into his churning stomach. This agent had been placed only a few leagues from the center of the whole operation, and not only that, had somehow been penetrated into the inaccessible one-moon universe where he lived in direct parallel to the single most dangerous human being on the two-moon Earth, Martin Winters. It was quite an achievement, and the problem was he had no idea at all whether or not the agent was dead. But North was a brilliant achievement, too, and he had to believe that the attack had worked.
"Can you guarantee it, General Samson?"
The only acceptable answer was yes. Anything less could bring torture and death.
"The agent is dead."
"Then let me report the good news to my wife. She's been very concerned about this aspect of the situation."
Samson fought for air. He needed to sit down, but there were no chairs here. As it was supposed to, the piercing light was making him feel naked and exposed. It was forcing him to shiver his scales, lest his body temperature rise and make him slow. There came, from behind the horrible shadow, piercing female laughter. It could only be her. Then the light went out. As Samson's eyes got used to the dimness, he had a great surprise. He saw that the entire board of directors was present, all of them, even Maisel's father, he noted. Behind the assembled board, an enormous window overlooked the Sea of Anubis, and a great longing entered Samson when he saw a ship, a pearl-white jewel tiny in the sun, its red sails rotating slowly in what must be a light breeze. How lovely their lives must be, those simple sailors, even the ones whose jobs would make their time short. The pitchmakers and the rope weavers and the scrapers. At least they did not risk their souls, not like a politician or a general.
"Come," Echidna said.
She actually took his hand. Up close, she was dazzling, a shimmering complex of the smallest imaginable scales, blushed pink under her high cheekbones, delicate blue around her smiling, sparkling, delightfully pale pink eyes, her body, easily visible beneath a floating gown of gossamer gold thread, was superbly curved, breathtakingly desirable. She was so vastly, incredibly different from the humble women on the bus, with their dull scales sagging with untended molt, that she might as well have been an entirely different species, not a seraph at all, but something from some grander and more extraordinary world than Abaddon. He followed her past the boardroom and into the private apartments, feeling her strong, cold hand in his. He forced his neck scales as tight as he could, but the musty scent of his desire still oozed from his pulsing glands. It made her throw back her head and laugh, and made Belleth nudge him from behind and hiss. Children's toys littered the legendary floor of pure gold, and kids playing darted between the feet of their elders. In the family shrine at the far end of the great room, the mistress's women attended their business, some sewing quietly while warming her latest clutch of black eggs, others listening discreetly to the proceedings.
"He will sit," Echidna called as they approached her ladies.
Chairs were brought by two young fashionistas, so highly bred that their scales were like white cream, almost as pale as hers. He found himself surrounded by gorgeous women. These really high aristocrats made even a highly bred noble like Maisel seem dreary. He strove not to appear as he felt, thunderstruck. Some of the children gathered, interested, no doubt, to watch whatever was about to befall him, because he had only won the first round. He looked across the impassive faces of the board members. Nobody was readable. All eyes stared straight ahead. The ultimate power rarely acted, and when it did, All were silent. Whatever she did, there would be absolute approval. Debate would end. She glared down at him, then leaned forward slightly and stroked his neck.
"Such interesting scales," she murmured.
And he saw something in her eyes other than the contempt he had expected. It crossed his mind that the old Echidna might have died and been replaced by another clone, and perhaps also another soul, one that might use the memories stored in the brain quite differently. With the Highborn, there was no way to tell who actually possessed a given identity at a given time, so this might not even be the person who had favored him and promoted him in the first place. She might consider that her memories of doing those things represented a mistake on the part of a predecessor. She looked into his face.
"I've seen no lying from you, but I have seen impetuousness and arrogance. I see that you despise us of good blood. You do, don't you?"
What should he say? The light was low, so any nervous flittering of his scales would not be seen.
"Of course I hate you, but I am loyal to you and to us all. I am loyal to our beloved Abaddon."
She tightened her grip on his neck. He began to feel his throat closing. She knew just what she was doing, and the way she dug her thumbs down into the sack of his craw, pressing it up so that it would be sucked down into his windpipe and make the throttling require less force, easier on the hands. He could no longer breathe. He waited. His penis stirred. Sex and death were so close. He felt his sheath draw back. Two of the girls giggled. One of them stretched herself. Children gathered closer. Time passed. She wasn't allowing even a trickle of air. Flashes came into his eyes, and air hunger now caused his body to torsion, throwing his abdomen forward and his head back. Amid peals of childish laughter, his bladder evacuated. Air rushed in, sputtering as the sack of his craw fluttered in his windpipe, then snapped back where it belonged. He coughed, tried to gain control of himself, then flounced back, helplessly kicking the air. As he gagged and spat mucus, everybody laughed. Kids ran up and spat on him and slapped him as he crawled to his feet.
"He pissed on us, Mama,"
one of them yelled. Then another, older one, "Kill him, damn you, you old hag!"
"Nobody kills him," she muttered.
A boy, his face flushing with eagerness, came toward him with a throating knife.
Let me get blooded, Mom."
"Stay away from him, you little shit."
"Dad, listen to her."
"Obey your mother," Belleth said.
"You people are such assholes."
"Watch your mouth, boy," Belleth said. "I'd just love to beat the shit out of you."
"You don't have the right."
"Shut up, both of you,"
Echidna snarled. She spat.
"I'll let your sisters whip you senseless, Meryl."
Little girls swarmed her, dancing around her, pulling at her skirts.
"Oh, Mommy, Mommy, please. Yes, he deserves it, please."
"Later. We'll talk it over."
She clapped her hands once, and all the children withdrew.
"Now listen to me, Samson. We need you to go back there and win this thing."
"I will, ma'am."
"How dare you lie to me?"
His blood literally dropped to his feet.
"Look at him," one of the fashionistas hissed. "He's scared to die."
He thought he'd passed this hurdle, but the agent was small stuff compared to the larger problem, which was that nothing close to 1 billion people were going to make it through the gateways because Two Moon Earth was not ready, not even close, and that was the real reason he'd been called back.
"I will not get 1 million people onto Earth, it's true, but I have something else that I am going to bring out. Echidna, I have the greatest treasure in history, and I lay it at your feet."
"This had better be good, Samson. Hyperbole annoys me."
"I have human souls in captivity, beautiful, healthy ones."
Her eyes widened. The only ones Abaddon ever captured were ugly and had to be sifted for the good bits, a sweet memory here, a compassionate act there, the things that smelled and tasted so good that could be relived endlessly, like a delicious food that would never be finished.
"A few souls changes nothing," she sighed. "Let's get him stripped. Get the skin off. I haven't got all night."
Somebody grabbed him from behind. The boy, who had wanted to kill him, came forward, a silver molting hook in his hand. He smiled up at Samson.
"This is not gonna be fast, you shit!"
"Ma'am, wait, ma'am! I have more than a few! More, ma'am!"
She gestured toward the eager boy, dismissing him.
"Mom!"
"How many do you have, Samson?"
"Ma'am, I have 10 million of them."
The silence that fell was absolute. This was indeed the greatest treasure in the history of the world.
10 million good souls?
"Ma'am, any one of them is better, more fulfilling, more delicious than the best you have ever eaten in all your memory. Fabulous, rich emotions, delight, love, sweetness, all the best stuff, ma'am."
He saw the calculation in her eyes.
"Where are they?"
He could feel the boy getting ready, could see his scales shimmer with eagerness. He had to be careful here, or she would kill him for insolence.
"Ma'am, they are under the stable gateway, ready to be brought through. I have them connected to 2 Moon Earths' core. They cannot escape. I can bring them through."
She gestured toward the boy, who swiped the air in front of Samson's torso, then hurled the molting hook at one of the board members, who dodged it, hissing and spitting. The boy glared at him as he adjusted his uniform.
"You'll be back, bitch," he said. "And when you get back, you and me, we got a date, do."
He ran his fingers across Samson's throat. Samson backed away, bowing until he was off the gold floor and onto the marble. When he saw its blackness, he almost wept with relief. On the way down in the lift, fear became rage. How dare they, those grunting, greedy Oru? He'd like to tear their living skin off their bodies with a molting hook, even her, yes, especially her. Tear it right off. The elevator opened, and he stepped out into the lobby. As he crossed it toward the great steel doors, he gloried in the fact that the guards were now indifferent to him, delightfully indifferent. The doors slid open to the wide esplanade of freedom, and he went through. So beautiful, life, despite the pain, the losses, the struggle, all of it. Life itself unfolding, so sweet. How dare they throw away his life for the amusement of a mere child? His life! As he descended the steps, part of him wanted to cry out to the brown sky, "I lived! I went to the top on a black ticket, and I lived!" He did not cry out, though. As befitted a general, he strode. He was walking toward the bus stop when a wonderful shoe, the best air car in the world, came swooping down so close that he had to duck lest he be clipped by it. It stopped, though, and hung there, its yellow surface gleaming, its black windows revealing nothing of the interior. Then the passenger door went up, and a pureblood leaned out.
"Hey, you Marshal Samson?"
"I'm General Samson."
"I've got orders to deliver this to a Marshal Samson. You got your number ID?"
Samson produced it. The salesman thrust the ID card into the slot. Samson heard the car's confirming bell. The salesman hopped out.
"She's yours, Marshal. Ever driven before?"
He forced himself not to gape. It was stunning. Instead of killing him, she'd given him a gift of one of the finest sports vehicles in the world, a wonderful, beautifully made creation that belonged only to the highest of the upper classes. Merely possessing such a thing raised you into the aristocracy. He entered the car. The fine interior gleamed with exotic metals, greens and silvers and golds. The leather was pale and as supple as cream, human, without a doubt, and young. He glanced across the dashboard, a forest of gleaming gold buttons, none of which he understood. Apparently, the car had every option you could imagine.
"I have no idea how to run this."
"You don't need to know. It's ensouled."
He was momentarily too amazed to speak. Shu ensouled perhaps 1,000 vehicles a year. Such a car would cost a man like him 10 lifetimes of income. Driving it identified him as one of the world's most powerful, most elite people.
"Is the soul human?"
The salesman laughed.
"Maybe next time, mister. It's a good one, though. Very smart, very compliant. You need to ride a human ensouled vehicle very carefully, you know. They're fast and really, really clever, but they can be tricky."
Indeed, they'd been known to smash themselves to bits in the hope of getting release. It didn't work, of course. They couldn't release themselves. But they ran a vehicle superbly. Experimentally, tentatively, he asked the car,
"Are you there?"
There was a pause, then, "Who are you?"
"The new owner. Take me home."
It hesitated a moment as it read his ID. "Yes," it said. He did not ask it why it had been put into a machine. He didn't really care, as long as it did its work. It was his now. That was all that mattered. As he soared upward, his engines singing, he called Echidna. "You're welcome," she said into his ear.
"How can I ever thank you?"
"I can think of two ways."
"Which are?"
"Open both human worlds, and I will grant you an entire city. I will break the law of blood and let you wear sky." The car swooped low into the dark streets of the back city, the real city. People looked up. Some knelt, all bowed, pulled off hats, raised their open hands to sign loyalty to the corporation. For nobody but an owner could be driving such a vehicle, a car glowing with the violet light of a soul. The door opened. He got out. Wide, amazed eyes, smiles everywhere, then cheering as his neighbors came to their windows, looked down and saw his triumph. Success honored all. He climbed the narrow stair, thick with the smell of boiling soup, and went into his apartment. There were meat parties everywhere in the street. The day's executions had favored his neighborhood, and they all thought he was the reason. And he was cheered from every door. Who knew? Maybe Echidna had given such an order. The gateway was open, waiting. He walked up to it. The stress waves shimmered evenly. It was as clear as he had ever seen. The approaching date was really having an effect now. Then he realized what he was looking at. Maisel stood in their cramped headquarters space beneath Two Moon Earth. She was looking down at the autopsy table. On it lay the body of Al North. He felt sick. That should not be. He stepped through.
"Is the agent dead?"
"You lived."
"Is the agent dead?"
She gestured toward North.
"This needs fixing."
"I told her."
His mind returned to the sick, vicious boy waiting for him with his molting hook. He shuddered.
"Never mind what I told her."
"We're going to try replacing the brain entirely," she said. "This almost has to get rid of the residual will. Then it's going to work."
"It had better work."
"Yeah, because if it doesn't, Daddy's gonna take away all your toys, and if you ever lie to my aunt again, I'll help my unpleasant little cousin take off your skin, and I'll eat it before your eyes." She smiled. "You're nothing, Samson. You and your ugly little car."
He bowed to her. Chapter 18. December 19th. Origins unknown. Nick sat reading the pages his father had just finished. Over the past 2 weeks, Dad had slept maybe 6 hours, but he was asleep now, sprawled like a corpse across his keyboard. Of course, corpses don't snore. It was 4 in the morning, and 2 weeks ago he wouldn't have dared to get out of bed and venture into the dark, but things had changed, hadn't they?
What's going on? Hi, Mom. What are you doing up?
Dad's written about being an intelligence agent.
Anything more than what we've already remembered?
Not really. When I came in here, he was sound asleep and snoring, and he was writing. He gestured toward the laptop.
This. It's a description of Samson going to the demon earth.
It's horrible, Mom, really horrible.
Wiley, wake up.
Mom, leave him. I don't want him like that. He needs a bed.
Look, if you disturb him, he's just going to start writing again. He's going to have a heart attack. Let him sleep.
She leaned over and read a few pages.
God, what a place. Abaddon. I Googled it. It means the abyss. At least it does in our language. In Serif, it probably means home or a nice place or something.
They're cannibals, and even the children torture and kill. It's like play for them. Like a video game to them to skin a real person alive. They're loathsome, Mom, and we do not want them here.
She looked down at her husband. I'm going to get him a blanket at least.
She went to the linen closet and pulled one down. They covered him together, mother and son, and Nick slid the cushion from his chair under his head.
I'm sober, I swear, he murmured.
It's okay, honey, it's good.
Let's fuck, baby.
Shh.
He gave a long snore and smacked his lips. I grew up with him, remember, Mom? She tried to laugh, almost succeeded.
Mom, the thing we have to ask ourselves is not only who Dad is and who we are, but what we're supposed to be doing. Because I have to tell you, I am starting to realize that I feel this incredible kinship with somebody in his book, and I want to understand what's going on. Trevor is like my soul brother or something. And another thing, this is dangerous. What happened with Al North trying to come in here, and that thing that came after Dad? It's very, very dangerous.
At that moment, there came a thin sound, almost like the wail of a smoke alarm. And for a split instant, that's what they all thought it was. Then Nick was running. They were all running. Kelsey stood in the hall outside her bedroom, clutching Barish and making this terrible sound, a noise Wiley had never heard his little girl make before and which he had not known she could make. Brooke leaped to her and enclosed her in her arms, and Kelsey sobbed the ragged sob of a child so terrified that not even her mother could comfort her.
There's hands in my room, and they were touching me, and when I threw Barish at them, I saw a face, and it was awful.
Oh, honey, there's nothing in your room. Look, it's empty in there. The light is on, and it's empty.
You saw just hands, Kelsey?
Yes, Daddy. They tried to grab me, and when they touched me, I saw them. Then they were gone.
And the face, you saw it?
When Barish hit it. It was bloody and awful, Daddy. It was horrible.
He looked at Nick. Nick looked back, his eyes steady with understanding. But he said nothing. No, and that was right. They had to be careful here. Extremely so, because there was a person in the house that they could not see, who had one goal, and that was to kill.
"Let's go downstairs and make cocoa," Nick said. "We need some cocoa."
"Nicholas, it's too late, and Kelsey's tired." Kelsey threw her arms around her mother's waist.
"Mommy, yes."
"Just one cup, then, and we have to make it quick, because my girl needs her beauty sleep."
She picked Kelsey up, and her little girl snuggled into her arms. As they trooped downstairs, Nick asked Wiley,
"Are we going hunting in the morning?"
"Hunting," his mother said, "on a school day?"
"Not for middle school," Nick replied smoothly.
Teacher's Day. Wiley understood exactly what his son was doing. He could not communicate openly, not if somebody was in here and they couldn't see him and they were listening.
We could go for pheasant, he said quickly. Maybe we'll put a bird on the table. The guns are ready so we can get an early start.
Let's pull him out then, Nick said. Wiley could feel the presence in the house just as clearly as Nick apparently could. An invisible something, and it was close. It was right on top of them. He unlocked the gun cabinet and pulled out one of their birders and tossed it to Nick, then got himself a 12-gauge.
Get behind us, he said to Brooke.
Excuse me? Mom, get behind us.
Wiley saw movement. Very clear, not 10 inches from his face, an eye, part of a face. And he knew something about who was here. It was a man, and he was horribly scarred. Al North was back for a second try. Then there was a hand around his wrist. He looked down at it, felt the steel of the grip.
It's on Daddy!
Kelsey screamed, and this time Brooke saw it, and she screamed too, and not just screamed, she howled. Nick fired into the seemingly empty space where the figure had to be, and there were a series of purple flashes in the general shape of a man, but the buckshot passed through him and smacked the far wall of the family room, shattering the big front window and leaving a trench in the top of the couch. The hand had gone. Nick grunted, and he was up against the wall. He was being throttled, and where the body of the intruder touched his, you could see edges of a black, tattered uniform. Wiley was not a huge man, not as big as Al North, but he waded in. From behind, he put his arms around North's neck and pulled his head back, gouging into his face. And as he did that, the face and head appeared, the stretched neck, arteries pulsing hard, and the eyes surrounded by scar tissue and dripping blood. Seeing this, Brooke went into the gun cabinet and brought out the big silver magnum she'd fussed and fretted for years about him even having. She waved it, not having any idea how to use it.
Wham! Wham! Wham!
Amid a showering mass of sparks, the figure flew across the room, slamming against the TV with a huge crash. It lay there, the left half of the head and face visible down to the left shoulder. Both hands and most of the left arm could be seen also, until the hand moved across where the stomach would be, slipping into an envelope of invisibility, then coming out again with blood on the fingers. The one visible eye was gray, glaring ferociously out of a blood-ringed socket. The surgery was crude and cruel. Until now, Wiley had not realized just how poor their doctor had been. The hand shot toward him again, like the head of a snake, and there was a knife in it, and the knife sailed at him, spinning, flashing metal, and clanged against the wall. There was a spitting, sparking sound and a burst of blue electric fire, and where it hit, reality seemed to peel back. Where there had been a blank wall, there was now a door with a blue shimmering frame, and beyond it a kitchen with a twisted, melted countertop, a toaster that looked like melted wax, a sub-zero fridge that had been clawed and melted and was hanging open. There were people there. And one of them looked in this direction. Wiley knew what he was seeing, and it was even more terrible than he had imagined when he was writing about these humanoid reptiles, because it was so sleek, so beautiful, with its shimmering pale skin, and so terrible with its empty, hard eyes, quick eyes, that focused fast on this room, then came alive with a glitter that could only reflect eager delight. Seraph. They called themselves, but we had names for them, from every culture in the world, from every time in history, but all these names amounted to the same thing, the one word that described something so exquisite and yet so ugly. He was looking straight into the eyes of what mankind in both human universes had identified as a demon. Kelsey ran toward it. She ran with a child's blindness and raw, instinctive hunger to find safety. No doubt she didn't realize what she was seeing. Maybe she saw a policeman,
black uniform, silver buttons, red collar patches, or maybe some other form of deliverance, but she ran to the thing, right through the opening and into the other universe, the dying universe, the place where they tore souls out of bodies and made wanderers of little girls. Wiley tossed Nick the 12-gauge.
"Blast it!" he yelled. "It's getting up!"
"Kelsey!"
Brooke screamed, running after her, leaping, trying, and failing to grab her flying nightgown before she went through the door, which made a faint, wet sound, a sort of gulping, as she passed through. She stood shimmering with bright violet light, as if she'd been trapped in some kind of laser show. The creature waiting for her went down and opened its arms, but the smile revealed rows of teeth like narrow spikes, and the golden eyes were not eyes of joy. They had in them the look of a famished wolf. Wiley dove in behind his daughter, feeling a hammering electrical pulsation over his whole body, followed by gagging nausea as he landed beside her. She was icy cold, her skin gray, and he had the horrifying thought that her soul was already gone. The demon had white hair, thin and soft, waving around its head like a halo.
"Hi," it said. "I'm Jennifer Maisel. It's good to meet you, Wiley."
The words were like blows delivered with a silk-clad hammer, so soft were they, so vicious the tone. He turned and faced a blank wall. The door was no longer visible.
"You'll need to come with me," the demon snapped. "You're here to stay."
But Wiley remembered the wisdom that had come down from one human age to the next, the whispered knowledge, and knew that she could only lie, and therefore threw himself and his daughter at the wall anyway. Behind him he heard a cry,
"Shit!"
And then he was home again. Nick was blasting the shotgun into the assassin, and Brooke was rushing to them, now grabbing her baby, now throwing both of them down behind the couch.
"Stay behind me, Dad," Nick said.
"Use the magnum, for Christ's sakes!"
"No bullets!"
Another blast of the 12-gauge rocked the world. Behind them there was a crackle and a hiss of rage, and the demon stepped through into the room.
As it did so, it became human. "You're under arrest, Wiley," Jennifer Maisel said softly.
What the hell universe did she think she was in?
"Not here, sweetheart,"
Wiley snarled. He'd picked up the empty magnum and now hurled it at her head. There was a flash of white-purple energy when it struck her. She turned away, her skin spurting red smoke. She gasped. Gasped again, put a long hand up to her jaw, then straightened up and produced a weapon of her own. It was blacker than night, this thing that was in her hand, with an ugly, blunt snout. Somehow he knew that he mustn't allow her to fire it, that it wouldn't tear them apart, not physically, that what it would do would be to splash out that light of theirs and rip the souls out of the whole family and hurl them into the control of the soul catchers and make this little family of his the first wanderers in this universe. He threw himself at her, and as Nick kept Al North back with blasts from the 12-gauge, he waded into her, his fists hammering, delivering blow after blow to what turned out to be a body hard with some sort of armor. Somewhere in there, he knew there would be something soft and vulnerable, a lizard's delicate meat, and he hit where seams might be, at the waist where she had to bend, and then the face. He hit the face, and it was just as hard, like steel. This structure of scales. She was like a thing made of garnet or steel, not a living creature at all. He went for an eye. Grabbing the skull with his fingers, he gouged his thumb into it and found there a softness that made him snarl with pleasure. "Beat the devil, Wiley. Why do you think you've got that name?" Behind him,
"Wham, wham! Wham, wham!"
Nick had had the presence of mind to reload the magnum, and he knew how to use it, too, holding it in both hands to compensate for his size and its power. Wiley routinely cleared him on all the guns. If they were going to be in the house, the kids were going to know their proper use and safety. Kelsey, too, when the time came. Whatever he was doing, though, it wasn't helping, because something had just jumped on Wiley's back. Shot up though he might be, Al had one hell of a lot of staying power. Then Wiley had an eye under his thumb. He damn well had an eye. Jennifer Maisel reeled back, hissing like the most enraged possible cobra. Her mouth opened wide, the teeth glittering, the interior as white as a snake's. The tongue gleamed black, was as thick as a finger and as long as a rope, and it came up slowly out of the throat. He'd never seen anything so menacing, never imagined menace like this being possible. Then the thing on his back let go, and he turned and saw Nick and Brooke standing over it. Nick had one of Wiley's superb Abatech hunting knives, and was thrusting and pulling expertly, and deep purple guts were spilling, and North's mouth gaped wide. The general's whole body shimmered, then began flickering like a light turning on and off, and there came great thunder, and outside and inside, blue flashing light, and then they were both gone, him and Jennifer Maisel.
"They're here!" Wiley shouted. "Still here!"
Nick thrust his knife at the air. Wiley picked up the 12-gauge and delivered a random blast into the ceiling, which rained down like the ceiling of Third Street Methodist had when Ron Biggs had emptied his 12-gauge into it in the Two Moon World. Outside, there was long thunder. Then he heard shouts, voices crying out in an unknown tongue, voices and the clatter of machinery.
"What is it?" Brooke hissed.
"Shh." They could see shadows cast on the floor, on the walls, big shadows, but not the people and machines making them. The physical people were in the version of the house that belonged to the Winters family, but as the 21st approached, the fabric that separated the universes in this very unusual corner of the world was becoming thin indeed. Wiley listened. He watched the shadows. One in particular, as it crossed the wall, something low being moved by two hunched figures. Then the figures bent over even further and lifted something that looked like a long sack and merged its shadow with the shadow of the object, then moved off.
"What is it, Dad?"
Nick asked.
"What's going on?"
"I believe that Seraph medics are carrying them out on gurneys."
"Oh, Christ, you're right," Brooke said. "That's what that is, all right. My God, what we're seeing here. I mean, just... my God."
The shadows were gone now. The house was quiet. The family came together, the children and the parents, struggling each in his own way with a trauma almost too intense to be borne.
"Mommy, can Barish have a drink? Because Barish would like an absinthe."
"Absinthe?"
She gave Wiley a careful look.
"Be it far from me."
"Daddy has a bottle of it in his liquor drawer in his office."
"Wiley?"
"There is no liquor drawer. There is no absinthe. I mean, it's illegal."
"Come on, baby. Show Mama the absinthe."
"Excuse me. We just nearly got killed here."
As if this return to their old life was the most welcome thing she could know, which it probably was, Brooke marched off to his office, followed by her little girl.
"Oh, come on," Wiley muttered, hurrying after them.
"Dad, don't lose focus now. This is not over."
"Brooke, there is no absinthe."
"Dad, come back.
Watch our backs," he yelled to Nick.
He entered his office behind Brooke, who was opening the desk drawers.
"It's behind the fake back in the file drawer," Kelsey said.
Wiley saw the empty desk, saw that there was no laptop there, saw that his old typewriter was melted like the Winter's toaster had been melted, his beloved old Corona oozing down the side of the desk like molten plastic.
"The computer is gone," Brooke said.
She looked at him. Her eyes were practically bulging out of her head. Tears were flowing.
"Dad, get down here, please," Nick called.
"What do you mean, gone?" Wiley said.
"It can't be gone."
But it was, and with it, their window into the other world. He felt suddenly numb, as if lobotomized, as if soul-robbed. "Do you have that copy?" he asked. She thrust her hand into the pocket of her jeans. She shook her head. "They got it." "They have blinded me," Brooke said.
"Which is what they probably came here to do."
"Dad, you better get to the front window right now." Coming from outside, from the front, he heard it. A deep rumbling sound, regular. The unmistakable noise of a big engine. He went to the window, looked down. Initially, he saw only blackness. Then he understood. What stood at their doorway was the most ominous thing he had ever seen.
"It's just sitting there, Dad," Nick said.
The huge Humvee gleamed black. Its windows were as dark as a cave. Its engine growled on idle. They had gotten one of their vehicles through the gateway. The engine stopped. There was movement behind the black windows. The doors began to open, and what they saw coming out was not human, not even remotely.